You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In 2016, voters passed Proposition 64, legalizing the sale and possession of recreational cannabis in California for adults 21 and over. Medical marijuana was legalized 20 years earlier in the state with the passage of Proposition 215 in 1996. But Prop 64 marked the creation of a much larger market that advocates promise would bring with it a windfall of new tax revenue. While opponents worried legal weed could lead to more dangerous roadways and higher rates of cannabis use in teens. Now that it's been almost a decade since its passage, health reporter Grant Stringer took a look at how Prop 64 lived up to the hopes and the concerns that surrounded it, and he's here to tell us more. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks.
So as we mentioned, it's been about a decade since Prop 64 passed. Remind us of the specific parameters of Prop 64, how it was set up for the recreational weed market.
Yeah, Prop 64 does a lot of things, but the big thing, as you mentioned, is that it legalized cannabis for recreational use and the possession of it, which was a big change in California. So you were no longer at risk of, you know, being incarcerated or at least arrested for possessing marijuana. The other big thing it did was that it set up this massive regulatory scheme that dictates how cannabis can be grown, how it can be packaged, what it can be grown with, like things like, you know, potentially dangerous chemicals and pesticides, and, you know, how it's handled at dispensaries, things like that. The other thing that it did was that it set up pathways for people to be able to have post-conviction relief if they had been convicted of marijuana-related offenses in the past, right, which were thousands and thousands of people in California who had been, you know, criminally punished for this thing that was now legal as of 2018.
I remember in 2016 that advocates for Prop 64, they promised voters that legalizing cannabis for recreational use would bring a host of new tax money to state and local governments. I mean, did it deliver on that promise?
Sort of. And that's the case for a lot of things with Prop 64. Depending on who you ask, it's either an abject failure or it's this, you know, okay system that's limping along. And the tax revenue, I would put in the category of limping along. So after the first licensed dispensaries opened in 2018, there was a spike in tax revenue to the state. That unfortunately plateaued pretty quickly and actually fell. So for the last few years, it's been about stagnant. Still, it is bringing in money. So in the last quarter, it brought in about $300 million to the state.
Hmm. How are retailers faring, those who, you know, joined the recreational cannabis market?
Yeah, it's worth saying up front that it is hard to operate a licensed cannabis business. There are tons and tons of really strict regulations, like I said, dictating all sorts of things about cannabis, right? How it's stored, how it's packaged, potency, things like that. What we've seen in the industry over the last 7 or 8 years is that it's become really consolidated. So there are a lot of really big players, especially in the grow industry. It's harder for smaller businesses, like one I visited in San Jose. This man who's in his 30s, named Brando Duong, got in on the ground floor. He set up a medical dispensary with his dad before Prop 64 passed. Since then, he sighed when I asked him how business was going, and he said it's been limping along. When I was there, the number of his employees like far outnumbered the number of customers who were actually coming in to buy flower or you know, gummies or anything else.
We've had some of these conversations over the years on this show, like even going up to like Humboldt County, you know, called the Emerald Triangle, and how like the last 10 years has really challenged the industry and businesses up there to even retailers, you know, across, you know, the Central Valley in California. One of the promises was that, you know, by legalizing recreational marijuana, it would shrink the black market. But it doesn't seem like that actually happened. In your data that you cited in your reporting, the black market has produced 8 times as much cannabis as licensed growers did back in 2024. So what is going on there? Why did legalization not curb the black market?
Yeah, so there's a debate around Prop 64, when advocates were stumping for it on the campaign trail, about the role that black market enforcement would play post-legalization. And it was ultimately decided, and this is what voters approved, that the criminal penalties for growing illegally without a license were actually downgraded. So what once used to be a felony is now a simple misdemeanor. So critics of that approach, and there are many now, like hindsight is 2020, they say that that has effectively removed the criminal penalties for refusing to participate in the legal market, right? So on top of that, there are all sorts of economic incentives not to participate in the legal market. For instance, you don't have to comply by any environmental or labor standards. So that immediately puts black market producers at an advantage. So as you said, you know, California really is awash in black market pot. It's a huge challenge for the state. There are all sorts of really, really negative impacts associated with this, from environmental pollution, which is real and widespread, to labor exploitation, particularly of undocumented people who might come up from Mexico or Central America, seek legal work, basically become unable to find it, and end up working in very far-flung, off-the-beaten-path places where there's just no oversight, you know, putting them at risk of everything from wage theft to actual violence, which has been well documented.
Yeah. And when it comes to this black market, it's not just in, you know, remote areas. I mean, you found that it could just be even like in a neighborhood, right?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm here in the Bay Area in Oakland, in Alameda County. We have a major problem with black market grows here. Contra Costa County, in particular Antioch, has also had a major challenge with illegal grow houses, you know, operating just in like, you know, normal looking suburban homes.
So it just seems like the legalization of recreational marijuana, Prop 64, had some maybe unintended consequences incentivizing the black market. But on the flip side, for those who do want to go the legal route, I mean, I've also heard that it's just so expensive to be a legitimate business in the marijuana market here in the state.
Yeah, it is expensive. I think every industry, when you're writing about businesses, they do cry out for regulatory relief. You know, I've experienced that reporting on everything from oil and gas to actually the first licensed psilocybin mushroom industry up in Oregon. But it is true that the tax burden is quite high on licensed cannabis businesses here. That has become a mainstream position, so mainstream that the legislature and the governor's office have repeatedly paused or done away with taxes. So for instance, you mentioned that, you know, it might be hard to run a legal grow operation. The state used to have something called a cultivation tax that was a special tax on cannabis growers, and they completely did away with that in 2022. Lots of other counties, like up in the Emerald Triangle, have done the same thing.
So on the flip side, the state is also receiving less revenue.
It is. A little bit less than its peak in 2021, for sure.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with health reporter Grant Stringer about a retrospective piece looking back at nearly 10 years of legalized marijuana in California. Going back to 2016, opponents, those against Prop 64, they had warned that more teens would obtain cannabis if Prop 64 passed. You know, a decade later, did that concern come to fruition?
It did not, although that's according to the state's data. And it's worth acknowledging that this is fiercely debated and you get into the weeds very quickly on this. There are interest groups dedicated to proving that, you know, teen cannabis use increases in states that legalize recreational use. But California's own data actually shows a decline. I spoke with a Stanford professor about this, who researches drug policy. His name is Keith Humphreys. He also penned a wonderful piece about this phenomenon in The Atlantic. And he said that decline in teen use here in California isn't surprising, given that teens are doing a whole lot less of all sorts of harmful activities like drinking and smoking, basically because they're, you know, more isolated and using their phones.
Another concern that I remember is that roads, driving, would become more dangerous. Did we see an increase in, I guess, DWIs related to marijuana use in the last 10 years or so?
That was a huge concern from opponents of Prop 64. That did not come to fruition. So the state keeps data on drug-related DUIs, and that's for all drugs. But in that category, DUIs have actually declined since Prop 64 went into effect.
Okay. Another interesting part about Prop 64, yes, voters approved it statewide, but it is fragmented. There is this patchwork, because while the personal use of pot legal throughout the state for 21 and older, you know, it allowed cities and counties to decide if they wanted cannabis businesses in their areas. So how did this patchwork approach play out in the last 10 years?
Yeah, I was really surprised about this when I started researching this topic. I was unaware that retail dispensaries are banned in 56% of cities and counties in California. So more than half. That obviously opens up a huge opportunity for black market sellers and producers. I was also surprised to find that the Bay Area actually has a huge swath that has like almost no dispensaries, and that is Silicon Valley, you know, which is famous for this like libertarian strain. And cannabis was obviously a big part of like early Silicon Valley culture. But aside from the city of San Jose, which has lots of retail dispensaries and has really embraced the legal industry, Silicon Valley is a no-go zone for legal weed purchases. So if you live there, you know this well, you're going to have to drive up the peninsula, or you're going to have to drive over to San Jose to buy some marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate your reporting, because you're painting like a realistic, complicated picture from a law that, you know, could seem simple on the surface, legalizing recreational marijuana. And we've been looking at places and at parts of this law where maybe it didn't come to fruition or it isn't working out so well. But in your reporting, are there any places or parts of Prop 64 which is actually like doing well and working out? Is there an area in the state that's thriving after Prop 64?
Yeah, I don't know about thriving, but San Jose is a good example. San Jose set up a very regimented program to promote like a small number of dispensaries, and they chose their applicants really carefully. They also have an equity program that tries to promote people who are underrepresented in the business, which is largely comprised of business owners who are like white and wealthier, coming from outside of the industry. So San Jose has reaped a lot of tax revenue. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's especially a couple of years ago, it was a really sizable part of their budget. Mm. They've benefited in part from that geographic phenomenon that I mentioned, where people are driving from all over Silicon Valley, you know, to go buy pot legally there.
Did you get an idea of what the legal cannabis market looks like here in the Sacramento area?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you have the same situation as Silicon Valley, actually. So if you live in Sacramento proper, you're good to go. You can walk down the street and probably find a dispensary. But if you are in the rest of Sacramento County, you are unfortunately out of luck. You're going to have to buy pot on the black market or drive to Sac. The other city, which is tiny, that allows retail sales is this tiny town called Isleton, which I understand has some budgetary issues at the moment. So maybe they have turned to cannabis as a possible source of tax revenue.
I want to go back to the 90s when medical marijuana was passed. Is there still medical marijuana? Can people still get a prescription to get marijuana? Does that still work?
Yeah, that's my understanding, although I am not up on that, on the current regulations, which, you know, things change really quickly in this space. But my understanding is that, yeah, medical is still an option for people. Yeah. So maybe someone will correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, Grant, you know, as we wind this conversation down, you know, for years, like obviously California has legalized marijuana, but at the federal level, like that is not the case. But there has been a big change. I mean, last week, President Trump, he signed an executive order that downgraded legal restrictions on medical marijuana. Do you think that will have like any impact here in California?
So it's not going to have an immediate impact on the recreational industry here. The expectation is that federal officials are going to start considering that similar downgrade for recreational cannabis. So, you know, these things are really incremental. The Biden administration also moved very slowly to start to, you know, consider downgrading the restrictions around cannabis. What the Trump administration is doing is really two things, which is that it's going to allow medical cannabis companies to come into the light, in a sense. They're going to be legitimized, and they're going to be able to get a tax break on business expenses, which I'm told is going to be quite helpful for them. Like the kind of thing that the recreational industry would probably be salivating over. The other thing is that it's going to make it easier in some ways for researchers to work with medical cannabis, which there's a lot more research that is needed about this space. So I know there's a lot of excitement around that.
As a health reporter, when you were taking this, you know, 2020 view back, you know, looking at 2016, the last 10 years of this law, did you go into it with some assumptions and then were proven wrong? I guess what surprised you most in your reporting journey?
Yeah, that's a great question. What surprised me most was that adults in California are not using cannabis more than they used to. Use among adults is flat. And as I said, among teens, it's actually down. What is interesting, though, and this is something that Keith Humphreys from Stanford and I talked about, is that of people who smoke or use cannabis in some way, they're using a lot more. So there's a smaller portion of Californians and Americans writ large who are using cannabis heavily. And that's the kind of thing that's going to be studied, you know, in coming years and decades. There are all sorts of health impacts associated with that, from, you know, cognition and mental health to, if you're smoking, you know, lung conditions. So whereas, you know, chronic alcohol use is by the numbers is far more widespread in the US, and alcohol remains far more destructive than cannabis, it's actually not even a comparison. There is this smaller segment of Americans that are using cannabis really, really heavily now.
Where's your reporting going to take you next?
You know, I'm not actually sure about that. I'm curious about the health impacts, as I mentioned, especially around teen use. There are questions that are being studied and debated among psychiatrists and other medical professionals about the potential for cannabis use to exacerbate schizophrenia among teens. But that is also, you know, that research is still in early phases. So that's something I'd like to stick with.
Grant Stringer is a health reporter for Mercury News and the East Bay Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking about his article detailing the state of the legal cannabis market in California nearly 10 years after Prop 64 passed in 2016. We have a link to his article on our website. Still ahead, a local choir has been using their voices to raise money for charity for over 25 years. We'll talk to the founder of RSVP about the group's performances this weekend. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.